distance, Anders recognized the man who'd first opened the hatch of the spacecraft. "That was really great, Corporal," Anders said. "I noticed, though, that when you poked your head in, you fell backward. Was it the way we looked?" "No, sir," the man replied. "It was the way you smelled." The astronauts had a good laugh about that one. By now, it had been several hours since splashdown. In Houston, Susan, Marilyn, and Valerie tried to adjust to the idea that they needn't worry anymore, that today was now just a regular Friday. At Mission Control, it was finally time to celebrate. Consoles were unplugged and data secured, and many of the controllers and managers returned to the haunts that had been bridges for the endless nights and years they'd spent working to get to the moon. Some went to the Singing Wheel, some to the Flintlock, others to the Holiday Inn across from NASA in Houston. Most everyone drank and smoked cigars and raised toasts. At the Flintlock, John Aaron and Rod Lowe, who'd worked with Anders to write mission rules and procedures, stood at the bottom of the stairs, not yet ready to go up and join the party. "What are you guys doing?" a friend asked. "Why aren't you upstairs?" Lowe thought it over for a moment. "We're just standing here thinking how proud we are to be Americans," he said. Borman, Lovell, and Anders dined on lobster tails and roast beef that evening with Captain Fifield, then collapsed in comfortable beds made up with crisp, fresh sheets, getting their first good sleep in more than a week. The next morning, they enjoyed steak and eggs with some of the Yorktown's officers. That day, December 28th, the astronauts boarded a carrier plane and flew from the Yorktown to Hickam Air Force Base in Hawaii. From there, they transferred to a C-141 transport plane for a flight of more than 8 hours to Houston. For Anders, it would be the longest flight he'd ever endured, other than the one aboard Apollo 8. The plane reached Ellington Air Force Base after 2 o'clock a.m. on Sunday, December 29th. Hundreds from NASA and 3,000 well-wishers, many holding banners with congratulatory messages, were there to greet the astronauts, who were clean-shaven, dressed in blue coveralls, and wearing baseball caps. Under a half-moon, Borman, Lovell, and Anders found their wives and children, gave them red and purple leis from Hawaii, and pulled them close. 8-year-old Gail Anders gazed at her father, grateful to have him back and not sure she should ever let go. The Borman boys wore ties and beamed at their dad. The Lovell kids orbited their father, pushing close for his attention, never staying on his far side for too long. Borman stepped up to a microphone, his wife's red lipstick smudged across his face. "Thank you for coming out so early in the morning to welcome us," he said. Lovell added, "At 2 in the morning, I expected to get in my old blue bomb and go home." Lovell's blue bomb was the family's no-frills 1962 Chevy Biscayne. The astronauts thanked the crowd and their families at a microphone, greeted NASA's managers and controllers, and smiled for photographers. One boy in the crowd told his friend, "I know they didn't have radiation because I just shook their hands." Then it was time for the astronauts to go home. But that wasn't proving so easy. The crowd pushed forward, surrounding the crewmen and their families, thrusting dollar bills to be autographed. In the surge, Bill Anders became separated from Valerie. NASA staff scurried to reunite the couple, but no one seemed to mind such a short separation, least of all the two of them. Each of the families finally climbed into their car and drove off. In their rearview mirrors, the astronauts could see throngs of people waving goodbye until they'd pulled out onto the Houston roads, and there was only black night behind them. None of the men said much about his trip as he drove home. They just said how happy they were to be back, that all had gone as perfectly as could be imagined, and that they felt lucky. None of them was inclined to philosophize about the trip. Not yet, anyway. Over the years, these men had become expert at coming home from missions, forgetting about the risks they'd just undertaken, getting on with their day. No other kind of men could have climbed into such unproven flying machines. These were the kind of men NASA had always wanted. When Borman, Lovell, and Anders opened their front doors, they found Christmas trees still glowing and presents waiting for them, and they knew that this was just how their homes had looked on Christmas Eve, when they had been 240,000 miles away at the moon. And they knew that this was how their homes would have looked, no matter how long it might have taken them to return. The next morning, as the Bormans sat down for breakfast at the kitchen table, Frank asked the boys about football and hunting, and demanded to know why dog food had been left in the bowl while he was gone. As for Edwin's broken thumb, by the look on their dad's face, they knew there had better be a good explanation for that. When the family opened presents, Susan found a new dress Frank had bought for her before he'd left for the moon. He'd always loved shopping with her, and knew her style and size. In the days that followed, it seemed the world talked only about Apollo 8. A New York Times editorial called it the most fantastic voyage of all times. The Washington Evening Star announced that man's horizon now reaches to infinity. The Los Angeles Times said the mission boggles the mind. And Time magazine rushed to change its iconic Man of the Year cover from the Dissenter to astronauts Anders, Borman, and Lovell. Even the Soviet Union could not hide its admiration. Apollo 8, the nation said, goes beyond the limits of a national achievement and marks a stage in the development of the universal culture of Earthmen. In a congratulatory note, several Soviet cosmonauts lauded their counterparts for the precision of your joint work and your courage. Telegrams for the astronauts poured in by the thousands. One, however, stood out from the rest. It came not from a world leader or celebrity or other luminary, but from an anonymous stranger. It had traveled over whites-only lunch counters in the South, through jungles in Vietnam where young men fell, over the coffins of two of America's great civil rights leaders. It had blown across streets bloodied by protesters and police, past a segregationist presidential campaign, into radios playing songs of alienation and revolt. It had made its way through 10 million American souls who didn't have enough to eat, alongside generations that no longer trusted each other, into a White House where a no longer loved president slept. It read, "Thanks. You saved 1968. Epilogue. As the world celebrated Apollo 8, most didn't realize just how successful the flight had been. By NASA's analysis, all mission objectives had been attained. The command and service modules had performed beautifully at the moon. Deep space communications had been excellent. Mass cons, the anomalies in lunar gravity, were better understood. Navigation over lunar distances was proved with exquisite accuracy. Lunar landmarks were confirmed for future missions. And the Saturn V rocket, which had been so troubled on only its second test, performed almost flawlessly on its third. Despite the breakneck pace at which they had been working since August, few at NASA took time off during the last hours of 1968, especially those responsible for analyzing photographs and movies returned by Apollo 8. Experts developed film by hand rather than by machine, a painstaking process that assured the film could be salvaged if mistakes were made. Anders was at home in Houston on December 29th when some of the pictures were developed. Pictures unlike any mankind had seen before. Shots he took of Earthrise showed the bright blue and white marble of Earth rising over the moon's gray horizon, the only color in an all-black universe, a tiny, shining oasis in the cosmos. NASA selected the best one of Anders' Earthrise photos, and on December 30th, it appeared on the front pages of newspapers across the globe. Days later, it would run in full color in magazines and Sunday supplements. Most everyone published the photo with the moon's surface horizontal, though Anders and his crewmates had witnessed Earth rise with the lunar surface both horizontal and vertical. To Anders, both perspectives were correct. There was no real up or down in space. In the following year, the United States Postal Service would issue a new stamp featuring the Earthrise image. In a year of historic photographs, of the street execution of a Vietnamese prisoner, of Martin Luther King Jr.'s associates pointing in the direction of his assassin, of Robert F. Kennedy lying mortally wounded in a busboy's arms, of the Black Power salute at the Summer Olympics, the image of Earthrise captured the world's imagination. In case anyone had missed it, President Johnson sent a print of Earthrise to every world leader. Grateful for the attention the photograph produced, the Hasselblad Company, which made the cameras used by the astronauts aboard Apollo 8, offered a brand new one to Anders. A stickler for regulations, he declined. By his reading, government rules made it illegal to accept gifts. As America rang in the new year, NASA continued a series of debriefings with the crew of Apollo 8. Borman, Lovell, and Anders were together for these meetings with agency officials, where they provided comments on every aspect of Apollo 8 and made recommendations for future missions. Some remarks were matter-of-fact, as when Anders suggested better light control settings on television cameras. Others reflected excitement, as when Lovell said, "There are a tremendous amount of craters that are not picked up in Earth-based or Earth orbital-based photography. There are many more new craters to be seen in lunar orbit." Or, when Borman described re-entry, "The whole spacecraft was lit up in an eerie, iridescent light very similar to what you'd see in a science fiction movie. I remember looking over at Jim and Bill once, and they were sheathed in a white glow. It was really fantastic." As fascinating as these descriptions were, the agency wanted to complete their investigations into the flight as soon as possible, as the astronauts had a busy January on their hands. It began at the White House on January 9th, where the astronauts each received NASA's Distinguished Service Medal from President Johnson. From there, Borman, Lovell, and Anders rode in their motorcade through flag-waving throngs to Capitol Hill, where they provided an informal briefing to a joint session of Congress and the Supreme Court, and received a 2.5-minute standing ovation. Lovell told the distinguished audience that a few days after returning from the flight, he'd walked outside his home in Houston and gazed up at the moon. "I could scarcely believe I was there," he said. The men then moved to the State Department, where they held a press conference. Before opening the floor to questions, a NASA spokesman announced that Borman had been named Deputy Director of Flight Crew Operations, an administrative position that would ultimately involve advising the White House on NASA affairs. One reporter asked, "Was there any moment during the mission in which you were a little bit scared or frightened?" "I was scared or frightened during a lot of the phases of the mission," Anders said. "But I think that fear is a normal human reaction, and one that is not detrimental to the flight as long as you keep it under control." Another reporter asked, directly, when America would land on the moon. "This summer," Borman said. "Can you be more precise?" the reporter asked. "Apollo 11, Borman said. What Borman didn't say was that he, Lovell, and Anders might have been the crew for Apollo 11. If only Borman had wanted it. Deke Slayton, who assigned crews, thought that the Apollo 8 astronauts were best positioned to train for the first moon landing since they'd already made a lunar orbit flight. But given Borman's decision that Apollo 8 would be his last trip in space, Slayton didn't need to further consider Borman and his crew. In the end, Slayton decided to stay with the planned rotation, with Neil Armstrong as commander of Apollo 11. The day after the press conference, the astronauts were honored with a ticker tape parade in New York City, an appearance at the United Nations, and a party at the Waldorf Astoria with Mayor Lindsay and Governor Rockefeller. Celebrations and parades followed that week in Newark, Miami at the Super Bowl, Houston, and Chicago, where more than 1 million people turned out. During the festivities, the astronauts never forgot that there was a war going on in Vietnam in which their friends and colleagues continued to risk their lives and die for the United States. To Borman, Lovell, and Anders, countless men were doing more for their country in Vietnam and elsewhere than the astronauts had done by flying Apollo 8. Men that no one would ever know about. Brothers, the crew of Apollo 8 tried to remember every day. On January 20th, following Richard Nixon's inauguration, NASA announced that Lovell and Anders would be on the backup crew for Apollo 11, the mission expected to make the first lunar landing. That meant if the primary crew, Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, and Mike Collins, made the trip, Lovell and Anders likely would be primary crew for another lunar landing, Apollo 14. However, Slayton had made Anders the backup command module pilot for Apollo 11, which meant Anders would be the one who stayed with the orbiting spacecraft while his two crewmates flew the lunar module to the moon's surface and back. To Anders, the writing was on the wall, just as he expected. He'd mastered the spacecraft so beautifully on Apollo 8 that no one would ever let him leave it. In late January, President Nixon sent Borman and his family on an 8-country goodwill tour of Europe. At each stop, Borman was greeted as a hero, and people listened with rapt attention as he described his adventure around the moon. In Rome, he and his family met the Pope and stood on the same piece of ground where Galileo had been condemned for heresy in 1633 for advocating Copernicus's argument that the Earth travels around the sun. Of the crew's reading from Genesis, Pope Paul VI said, "For that particular moment of time, the world was at peace." Flush with confidence and shot full of momentum from the success of Apollo 8, NASA entered its final push to land men on the moon. It would require two flights, Apollo 9 and Apollo 10, to prepare for a landing mission sometime in the summer of 1969. But after Apollo 8, the space agency believed there was virtually nothing it couldn't do. It was around this time that NASA asked Borman to talk about the space program and Apollo 8 at American colleges. Some welcomed him. Many more did not. Often he was shouted down by protesters who resented the presence of a military man on campus. At Columbia University in New York, he was pelted by marshmallows, then overrun on stage by students dressed in gorilla costumes. In Boston, a helicopter had to deliver him past the mobs that blocked access to his speech. But the worst experience came at Cornell University, where astronomy professor Carl Sagan invited Borman and Susan to his home for a round table with students. The Bormans accepted, then were treated to an evening of attacks on America and its conduct in Vietnam, all of it encouraged by Sagan, whom Borman would never forgive for the treatment. After Apollo 9 and Apollo 10 flew successful missions in March and May 1969, Borman and his family boarded a plane for another goodwill trip, this one to Russia. The Soviet ambassador to Washington had extended the invitation, and President Nixon thought it a positive step toward easing tensions between the two nations. With the president's permission, Borman and Susan brought their sons. As the first astronaut ever to visit Russia, Borman was given first-class treatment and shown some of the Soviet Union's proudest sights. He was given a tour of the highly secret Star City near Moscow, where cosmonauts lived and trained, laid wreaths at the resting places of Soviet leader Vladimir Lenin and cosmonaut Yuri Gagarin, sampled wines in Yalta, and met with the top Soviet physicist. One night, he and his family were honored at a crowded dinner at the Regal restaurant in Moscow's famed Metropole Hotel. One of the cosmonauts in attendance, Alexei Leonov, was struck by a piece of Borman's attire. In place of a traditional necktie, he wore a bolo tie set with a bright blue stone. "Everyone wanted to stand near him," Leonov would later write of the evening, "to touch him." Borman congratulated Leonov on his 1965 spacewalk and described how the moon had appeared close up, then showed slides of his lunar journey to a rapt audience. Although Borman had considered the Soviet Union an enemy, he liked the Russian people and held the cosmonauts in the highest regard. No Westerner better understood the rigors of their training or the great risks they took for their country. Susan took a ring from her finger and gave it to a cosmonaut, a gift from her family to theirs. By trip's end, Borman saw the cosmonauts as he saw the astronauts, a group of test and fighter pilots, all of whom wanted more than anything else to help their country succeed. And he admired their candor. To a man, they seemed generous in acknowledging that America had won the race to the moon. On July 16, 1969, NASA launched Apollo 11 from Cape Kennedy. On board were astronauts Armstrong, Aldrin, and Collins. Orbiting the moon, Armstrong gave a shout-out to Apollo 8. "We're over Mount Marilyn at the present time," he radioed to Houston. A day later, July 20th, Apollo 11's lunar module set down on the lunar surface at one of the sites at the Sea of Tranquility scouted by Apollo 8. "The Eagle has landed," Armstrong radioed to Mission Control. 6.5 hours later, Armstrong exited the spacecraft, climbed down its ladder, and set foot on the moon. "That's one small step for a man, one giant leap for mankind," Armstrong told the world. Aldrin followed onto the lunar surface several minutes later. Just 8 years after a young president had pledged to do the impossible by decade's end, America had made good on his promise. Men had landed on the moon. In early August 1969, the atheist Madeline Murray O'Hare and her affiliated group brought a lawsuit against NASA and its chief, Thomas Paine, for allowing the reading of the first lines of Genesis by the crew of Apollo 8 during lunar orbit. That action, O'Hare claimed, abridged her First Amendment right to be free from religion and violated the First Amendment by establishing Christianity as a state religion. Further, she alleged that NASA had chosen Christmas for Apollo 8's mission for religious reasons. She asked the court to prevent NASA, a public agency, from future religious displays or readings. A United States District Court judge threw out the lawsuit. The United States Supreme Court refused to hear O'Hare's appeal. By the time Apollo 11 had returned from its historic mission, some shuffling had gone on with Apollo crews. Anders, who believed he'd never be given the chance to walk on the moon, accepted a job at the National Aeronautics and Space Council in Washington, D.C., a body chaired by the Vice President of the United States and devoted to establishing the country's space policy. Anders took the job on one condition, that he retain his astronaut status in case a miracle occurred and Deke Slayton gave him a walk on the moon. Lovell had been advanced in the cycle to command Apollo 13. For his part, Borman had become a special advisor to Eastern Airlines. Following a successful landing mission by Apollo 12 in November 1969, Apollo 13 launched with Lovell as its commander on April 11, 1970. That flight, however, never made it to the lunar surface. Near the moon, an oxygen tank exploded, severely damaging the service module and disabling the command module's power and air supply. 200,000 miles from Earth and unable to safely fire the SPS engine, Lovell and his crewmates, Jack Swigert and Fred Hayes, were in grave danger of being stranded in space forever. Tapping wells of ingenuity, creativity, and courage, Mission Control and the crew cobbled together a solution. They would use the lunar module for electrical power and thrust, repurposing it to keep themselves alive and to regain a free return trajectory that would whip them around the moon and return them to Earth. The world prayed for the astronauts as they sped home in their freezing spacecraft, while Lovell used the experience he gained from restoring Apollo 8's disrupted orientation during its own return to nurse the disabled Apollo 13 back to Earth. No one knew whether the command module's heat shield had been too severely damaged by the explosion to survive re-entry. In the end, Apollo 13 made it back safely, one of the great rescues in history. No one at NASA, least of all Lovell, failed to recognize that the crew had been saved by the lunar module's secondary role as a lifeboat. It was this lack of a lifeboat that had haunted so many who'd feared flying Apollo 8 to the moon. If the explosion aboard Apollo 13 had occurred during Apollo 8, Borman, Lovell, and Anders would never have come home. 5 days after Apollo 13's return, the first Earth Day observance was held, a series of demonstrations, celebrations, and rallies to protect the environment. Apollo 8's Earthrise photo was used as the movement's symbol. Some suggested it was Apollo 8 itself, man's first look at his home planet and at its thin, fragile atmosphere that launched the environmental movement. NASA made 4 more manned trips to the moon after Apollo 13, all of which successfully landed crews on the surface. Collectively, the astronauts on the Apollo missions returned almost 842 pounds of lunar soil and rock, samples that continue to form the bedrock upon which our understanding of the solar system's origins is based. In all, 12 Americans walked on the moon between 1969 and 1972. And that was it. Since Apollo 17, humankind has never returned. It has been 50 years since Apollo 8 flew to the moon. Many of the key managers at NASA who made the mission happen have since died, including former administrators James Webb and Thomas Paine, director of NASA's Manned Spacecraft Center Robert Gilruth, chief of astronaut division Deke Slayton, associate administrator for manned spaceflight George Miller, director of NASA's Apollo Manned Lunar Landing Program Samuel Phillips, and rocket mastermind Wernher von Braun. All 3 astronauts who served as CAPCOMs during Apollo 8, Mike Collins, Ken Mattingly, and Jerry Carr, are still living. Collins went to the moon as part of Apollo 11, Mattingly on Apollo 16, both as command module pilots. Carr became a commander on Skylab, America's first space station, in 1973 to 74. Apollo 8's lead flight director, Cliff Charlesworth, died in 1991. The mission's other 2 flight directors, Glenn Lunny and Milton Windler, are retired. At age 94, Chris Kraft remains as sharp and feisty as ever. After a long and distinguished career at NASA, he retired as the director of the Johnson Space Center in 1982, then served as a consultant for several major corporations. He still has strong opinions on the space program, still remembers, vividly, watching Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig hit home runs in the early 1930s. George Lowe, the mastermind behind sending Apollo 8 to the moon, became NASA's deputy administrator in late 1969. After retiring from the agency in 1976, he became the president of Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. In 1984, he was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom for his work with America's space program. He died the next day of cancer at age 58. In one of the last interviews of his life, in 2011, Neil Armstrong called Apollo 8 an enormously bold decision that catapulted the American space program forward. Harrison Schmitt, one of the 2 last people to set foot on the moon as part of the crew of Apollo 17, said of the flight, "It was probably the most remarkable effort that the NASA team down here ever put together." When asked to compare Apollo 8 to his historic flight, astronaut Mike Collins said, "I think Apollo 8 was about leaving, and Apollo 11 was about arriving. Leaving Earth and arriving at the moon. As you look back 100 years from now, which is more important? I'm not sure, but I think probably you would say Apollo 8 was of more significance than Apollo 11. Astronaut Ken Mattingly said, "Of all of the events to participate in, you know, I was lucky, because I could do Apollo 11 as well as 8, and then 13, But being part of Apollo 8, it made everything else anticlimactic. For Chris Kraft, it was simple. It took more courage to make the decision to do Apollo 8 than anything we ever did in the space program. Weeks after the return of Apollo 8, Frank Borman went to work pumping gas at a local Gulf service station in Webster, Texas. He did it for free, along with his two sons, in exchange for use of the station's garage bay and lift, where the Bormans could work on their cars. The station was owned by a family friend, Toki Kobayashi, a man who also raised world-class tomatoes for sale to restaurants in Chicago. Dressed in grimy jeans and a greasy t-shirt, Borman was almost unrecognizable to customers. One man who pulled in for gas began giving Borman a hard time, and for no good reason. Nearby, Borman's younger son, 15-year-old Ed, knew this was trouble. His father never started a fight but wouldn't take guff from anyone. Soon the men were near blows. Ed ran over and had to separate them, and it took every bit of his 200-pound frame to do it. Even as Ed moved the belligerents apart, he found himself thinking, this guy has no idea he's fighting with a man who just got back from the moon. One day, in 1969, as he was trying to figure out his post-NASA future, Borman's phone rang. On the line was a man who said, at the behest of Ross Perot, I have invested $1 million in your name. Perot wanted Borman to work for him by developing televised town hall forums in which the public could vote from home on issues of the day. The money, as the man said, had already been deposited. Borman was intrigued. Susan was not. You will not do that, she told her husband. He'll own you. You don't know anything about this. Borman gave back the money. He'd never made more than about $30,000 a year. Susan, who always received compliments on her fashionable wardrobe, would keep buying her clothes through secondhand stores and the Junior League thrift shop in Houston. More than ever, Frank was grateful for Susan's wisdom and good judgment. And he made a lifelong friend of Perot in the process. After retiring from the Air Force in 1970, Borman joined Eastern Airlines, a position that required him to move to Miami. By now, his son Fred was at West Point, but 17-year-old Ed was a senior in high school and still living at home. Eastern wanted Borman to attend a 3-month management program at Harvard Business School, a sure sign they had big plans for the former astronaut. Borman believed he needed Susan by his side in order to do his job well, so he asked his parents to stay with Ed for the year in Houston and asked Susan to move with him to Miami. The prospect of leaving her son during his final year at home was deeply painful to Susan. Her boys meant everything to her, but Frank needed her. So, she packed up the car and went with him, much as she had done in the early years of their marriage. She was still plagued by depression, and her drinking had grown heavier. As always, she never showed any of that to Frank. Borman rose quickly up the ranks at Eastern. While he impressed management, Susan struggled to adapt to a life in a new city, far away from her children and her friends. After his senior year, Ed followed his brother to West Point. For Susan, Florida felt emptier than ever. In 1972, an Eastern Airlines jet crashed in an Everglades swamp on a flight from New York to Miami. The site was inaccessible by land, and rescue efforts were slow to mobilize. Unwilling to wait, Borman chartered a 2-seat helicopter after midnight and flew with the pilot to search for the downed plane and survivors. The men found a tiny patch of solid ground on which to set down. Borman jumped from the chopper and into the waters of the swamp, which rose to his chest. All around, he heard moans and cries for help. He worked to unpin victims from wreckage, helped the injured into arriving rescue helicopters, searched with a woman for her missing baby. Working a system of flashlights, he set up a local flight control, guiding choppers in and out of the scene. He departed on one of the last rescue craft out of the area, flying to the hospital to monitor the treatment of survivors. Of the 176 passengers and crew aboard Flight 401, 98 died in the accident. Borman, who traveled constantly for work, was on assignment in New York in the fall of 1973 when he received a phone call telling him that Susan was very ill and advising him to return home immediately. It was past midnight, but he found an Eastern jet and jumped a ride on the empty plane. He had no idea what was wrong with his wife or how she was doing. It proved the longest and most helpless flight of his life. When he reached Susan's bedside the next morning, it became clear she'd had a nervous breakdown. "I can't live like this, Frank," she told him. "I'm very sick, but I'll do whatever it takes to get better." Borman didn't know what to do. The doctor at Eastern Airlines did. "If you leave her here, she's never going to get better, because she'll still be Mrs. Frank Borman of Eastern Airlines," he told Borman. The doctor had already made arrangements for Susan to go to the Institute of Living in Hartford, Connecticut, for treatment of her alcohol addiction and for intensive psychotherapy. On the flight to Hartford, Susan was nearly catatonic and didn't speak. At the treatment facility, the chief psychiatrist told Frank that Susan would need to be isolated and that Frank couldn't see or talk to her for a month. Frank couldn't imagine a more painful fate. Even at the moon, she'd been with him every moment. When doctors finally allowed him to visit, Frank found Susan much improved. They walked hand in hand across the grounds, and they talked. Frank felt a crushing guilt. All these years, he'd been selfish. Mission had always come before family, and he'd never realized the toll this had taken on Susan. He, too, attended counseling sessions. He considered resigning from Eastern, changing his hard-charging ways. But he realized, with the doctor's help, that such a move would run counter to his DNA. It would do no one any good if he tried to become someone he was not. Instead, he promised to himself and to Susan he would make more time for her, he would do more to communicate with her, and he swore to himself never to let anything like this happen again to the person he loved most. Susan stayed for 4 months at the Institute of Living before returning home to Miami. From that day forward, neither she nor Frank touched alcohol again. Susan even brought home a friend from the facility, a young woman with addiction issues who'd been rejected by her family. Susan helped the woman find an apartment and a job, then counseled her for months until she'd settled into the community. After that, Susan threw herself into volunteer work, helping organizations that fought drug abuse, an effort that would extend to a national scope in later years. Frank had never known a feeling of pride such as he felt for Susan in the months after she came home. In May 1975, Borman was elected president and chief operations officer of Eastern Airlines. He was beloved by many in the company, from board members to pilots to mechanics. Often, he worked unloading baggage at the airport or checking engine parts on the tarmac, and he drove an old Chevy to work. In a later newspaper profile, another airline executive would say of him, "He kind of preceded all the excellence books." Less than 2 years later, Borman became chairman of the board at Eastern, and he appeared in several of the company's television commercials. Even on TV, he couldn't help but talk straight. "Selling you a seat on Eastern Airlines isn't easy. It's not easy to sell you on any airline. You know, they're all pretty much the same," he said in one spot. For several years under Borman, Eastern enjoyed record-setting profits. But labor difficulties and the deregulation of the airline industry caused a downturn in the company's business. Borman fought to right the ship, even making concessions that went against his instincts. For a time, the moves worked. But after a downturn in the economy and new labor conflicts, Eastern was sold to new owners. After more than a decade at the helm, Borman resigned as the company's chairman in 1986. No longer bound to Miami, the Bormans moved to Las Cruces, New Mexico, where their son Fred owned a car dealership. While there, Frank and Susan enjoyed one of the easiest and happiest stretches of their marriage. Frank served on corporate boards, invested in the car dealership with Fred, and stayed close to their other son, Ed, who'd become a helicopter test pilot. Frank did a lot of flying of small aircraft, still a foundational pleasure. Susan designed and rebuilt a home in the desert. After more than a decade in New Mexico, Frank and Susan moved to Montana, following their son, Fred, who'd purchased a cattle ranch. Frank continued to fly in Montana's big skies and attended air shows across the country with Susan. People still recognize him in Montana sometimes. Some ask if he still looks up into the sky at the moon and thinks about having gone there. He smiles, but tells the truth. I suppose I do, but not often. Shortly after Apollo 13's safe return in 1970, political heavyweights in Wisconsin approached Jim Lovell about running as a Republican for United States Senate in his home state. He demurred, but that didn't stop Vice President Spiro Agnew, then President Nixon himself, from stepping in to press the recruiting effort. The election was just 6 months away. Even with a war chest from the party, Lovell still had no structure, no party history. He passed. The decision pleased Marilyn. She knew Jim would make a fine senator, but also knew that politics could tear a person's life and family apart. To her, going to the moon had been a safer bet than going to Washington. Lovell stayed at NASA for the next 3 years, working on early plans for the space shuttle and studying science applications for future space missions. The agency even sent him to a management program at Harvard, where he got his first taste of business. All the while, the Navy had been calling, urging him to come back to the fleet. But promotion in that service didn't feel right to Lovell. He'd been a captain. The next step up was admiral. After more than a decade at NASA, he'd be competing against men who'd studied war and seen serious combat in Vietnam. To Lovell, they would always deserve promotion more than he. Given his management experience at Harvard, it seemed time to make the move into the private sector. When he retired from NASA and the Navy in 1973, no man had spent more time in space than Lovell, a total of 715 hours and 5 minutes, or just 5 hours short of a month. As a private citizen, Lovell went to work for a tugboat company in Houston, where he became president and chief executive officer. The business proved lucrative, but after 4 years, Lovell found an even better opportunity as president of a telecommunications company. It grew exponentially with deregulation in the industry, then was sold to Centel, a larger telecom corporation, where Lovell remained as an executive and board member until his retirement in 1991. 4 years later, Hollywood released a film version of Apollo 13, a book Lovell had co-authored about the rescue of that ill-fated mission. Tom Hanks played the lead role and the film became a hit. Suddenly, everyone wanted a piece of Lovell, and he did his best to oblige, touring the country and giving talks with his usual warmth and good humor. The new notoriety also helped him launch Lovell's of Lake Forest, a restaurant on Chicago's Tony North Shore. Lovell packed the place with mementos from his NASA career, along with a giant mural behind the bar titled Steeds of Apollo that showed four horses galloping into the heavens. But the restaurant's real secret weapon was Lovell's son, Jay, its executive chef, who made Lovell's of Lake Forest a success. On most evenings, the restaurant was packed with patrons. On the night of September 11th, 2001, it was virtually deserted but for Jim Lovell himself. Dressed in his usual suit and tie, he stood alone in the corner of the basement bar, staring at the television, watching endless replays of terrorists bringing down the towers at the World Trade Center in New York. An American hero, not quite believing what had just happened to America. In 2003, Jim and Marilyn Lovell celebrated the 35th anniversary of Apollo 8 with Frank and Susan Borman and Bill and Valerie Anders. The reunion was warm and friendly, but it seemed to Lovell that Frank was doing everything, even making lunch, while Susan seemed not to contribute much at all. But the whole event was so nice that Lovell didn't think much more about it. 5 years later, the couples met for the 40th anniversary of Apollo 8. This time it was even more evident to Lovell that something was amiss with Susan. She acted strangely and hardly talked, and Frank constantly helped her, even with small things. Like his crewmates from Apollo 8, Lovell had flown private planes since retiring from NASA. Lately, he'd been piloting a twin-engine Cessna 421, able to make it from his home near Chicago to his other home in Texas, along with Marilyn, their dog, and luggage, in a slick 5 hours. But Marilyn had been growing increasingly concerned about her husband's flying alone. In the gentlest terms, she urged him to find a co-pilot or sell the airplane. In 2013, at age 85, he sold. Not a day passes when he doesn't miss it. In 2015, after a 16-year run, Lovells of Lake Forest closed its doors, a victim of the economic downturn that began in 2008. Jay Lovell and his wife, Doris, opened a smaller, more casual place in nearby Highwood, Illinois. Jim and Marilyn eat there often. At their home near Chicago, Jim and Marilyn lead a quieter life than they did during the NASA years, when they could hardly leave the house without attention. Now they enjoy their children and grandchildren, and a golden retriever they found at a rescue shelter, one that watches the Apollo 13 movie whenever it plays on TV. For many years, Jim and Marilyn's daughter, Susan, wore the mink jacket that Jim had sent to Marilyn on Christmas Day 1968 while he was orbiting the moon. But late in 2015, Marilyn asked for it back, if only for a Chicago winter shaping up to be colder than most. Even now, Marilyn and Jim go for nightly walks near Lake Michigan. The shoreline makes for a perfect place to gaze up at the moon, especially when it's full and just rising over the trees. In summer 2017, the International Astronomical Union formally recognized the name Mount Marilyn for the lunar mountain Lovell picked out for his wife during Apollo 8. Every once in a while during their walks, Jim shows Marilyn where it is on the moon. Every once in a while, he thinks, I've been there. By the time the last Apollo mission flew in late 1972, Bill Anders had been at the National Aeronautics and Space Council for almost 4 years. In that time, he'd worked on projects like Skylab, America's first space station, Viking, to put an unmanned spacecraft on Mars, and the space shuttle. He'd also lobbied successfully to include astronaut geologist Harrison Schmitt on Apollo 17. To Anders, it made little sense for the agency to send only test pilots to land on the moon. NASA needed someone who could expertly interact with and appreciate its geological wonders. Before going to Washington, Anders had made a deal with NASA that permitted him to keep using the agency's T-38 airplanes for as long as he worked in government. The move allowed him to stay connected with high-performance jets and kept him sharp, just in case NASA extended Apollo into the future and changed its mind about keeping Anders in the command module pilot's seat. Anders was still at the Space Council when he and Valerie welcomed their sixth child, daughter Diana. Soon after, he was appointed by President Nixon to the five-person Atomic Energy Commission, a move that made sense given that Anders was a nuclear engineer. And 2 years later, in 1975, he was named the first chairman of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. In 6 years of service in Washington, Anders had proved himself serious and nonpartisan. In 1976, a White House staffer reached out to Anders to see if he'd be interested in becoming an ambassador. Anders talked it over with Valerie, who expressed an interest in a country she'd found especially beautiful during a family visit. President Gerald Ford approved, and in 1976, Bill Anders became the United States Ambassador to Norway. While working in Oslo, Anders received a package from the International Astronomical Union, the organization in charge of naming surface features of planets. The IAU was pleased to announce it had named six lunar craters for Americans, the crews of Apollo 8 and Apollo 11, and 6 for Soviet cosmonauts. Included was a photograph of the craters. Anders was displeased. For starters, his crater wasn't the one that he'd named for his family during the Apollo 8 flight. Second, the astronauts' craters were in an area past the horizon that couldn't be seen. Third, the cosmonauts hadn't even been to the moon. Anders joked that as atheists, they wouldn't even pass the moon on their way to heaven. He called the organization and argued the astronauts' case. To no avail. The explorer's prerogative to name the places one discovered didn't seem to apply. Anders, however, wouldn't forget it. Years later, he would still be pushing the IAU to make things right. Anders finally left government service in 1977, joining General Electric as vice president of its nuclear products division. 2 years later, the company sent him to the advanced management program at Harvard Business School. When he returned, he became the general manager of GE's aircraft equipment division, a multi-billion dollar business. Over the next several years, Anders improved the division, all while absorbing the management style of GE's young new CEO, Jack Welch, who pushed to consolidate, simplify, move fast, and stay only in businesses in which his company could rank first or second in the industry. After 7 years at GE, Anders left to become chief operating officer of the aerospace and defense firm Textron. In 1989, he left that company to become vice chairman of General Dynamics, a major supplier of aircraft, tanks, and other weapons to the United States Department of Defense. By agreement, he would become the company's CEO a year later. On paper, the move might have seemed crazy. After the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989 signaled the coming end of the Cold War, defense contractors began to suffer, their wares no longer in name-your-price demand. General Dynamics seemed even worse off than its competitors, having amassed huge debt. It looked headed for bankruptcy. But Anders saw possibility in darkened clouds. On becoming CEO, he instituted many of the principles he'd seen Welch use at GE. Among other moves, he sold off any part of the business in which General Dynamics couldn't be a market leader. He worked hard to change the corporate culture and become efficient, replacing most executives and many personnel, getting rid of waste endemic to the industry, and focusing on shareholder return. He even pitched in as a test pilot, flying the firm's F-16 fighter jets, until he sold off that part of the business, too. The company's fortunes turned around fast. Billions of dollars flowed in, enough so that Warren Buffett purchased 16% of the company's stock, then gave Anders proxy to vote his shares. By the end of Anders' 3-year term as CEO, he was a darling of Wall Street and, by many accounts, had saved General Dynamics. After orbiting the moon, one industry analyst said, mundane business problems did not faze him. Anders stayed on at General Dynamics for another year as chairman of the board, then retired from the company, a wealthy man, in May 1994. Soon after, he and Valerie fell in love with the natural beauty of Washington State, where they bought a house on the water and established the Anders Foundation, a philanthropic organization devoted to supporting education and the environment. All the while, Anders kept flying. He'd already purchased a de Havilland Beaver airplane restored by his friend and former commander, Frank Borman, but what he truly envied was Borman's P-51 Mustang single-seat fighter bomber, a workhorse from World War II and the Korean War. "If you ever find another, let me know," he told Borman. Not long after, Anders found himself flying over Borman's home in New Mexico. He flipped open his cell phone and called to say hello. "Hey, Anders," Borman said. "I found a Mustang for you. Get your ass down here." The two men drove to inspect the plane. "I'll buy it if you test it," Anders told Borman. Borman, the old test pilot, put the plane through its paces. Anders wrote a check and then had an idea. He would start a museum dedicated to preserving and flying historic military aircraft. The Mustang would be one of the first pieces in the family's Heritage Flight Museum, opened in 1996 in Burlington, Washington. It would also be the plane Anders flew in the 1997 Reno Air Races. At age 64, he finished third in the silver race. Along with Valerie and their children, Anders has helped run the foundation and the museum ever since. He still feels young, even in his mid-80s. He's surprised to look in the mirror and find an elderly man looking back. He takes daily walks with Valerie, and he still flies. But not the warbirds anymore. Mostly, he takes a light two-seater, much like a Super Cub, over Washington skies. It's not a Mustang, or the F-89 he used to challenge Soviet bombers during the Cold War, but it's a hell of a lot better than not flying at all. And he still cares about the environment. He knows that most people understand that Copernicus and Galileo were right, that the heavens do not revolve around Earth. But he wonders whether, down deep, any of us really believes it. By his estimation, human beings must think, in their reptilian brains, that Earth is flat and infinite. Otherwise, they wouldn't treat it as badly as they do. To that end, the Anders Foundation continues to fight to protect the environment on the only planet any of us has. Nearing the 50th anniversary of Apollo 8, Anders thinks often of the view he got of his home planet from a distance of 250,000 miles. To him, Earth seemed staggeringly small, little more than a pinpoint in an infinite universe. That feeling has never left him. When he was young, Anders sometimes wondered about his place in the universe and whether he was special. After the moon, he didn't wonder about that anymore. After the moon, he knew he wasn't special, and it brought him a kind of peace. As of this printing, all three of Apollo 8's astronauts were still married to their wives. They are the only crew that flew in either the Gemini or Apollo programs whose marriages all survived. A few years ago, doctors diagnosed Susan Borman with Alzheimer's disease, for which there is presently no cure. It was symptoms of this illness that Lovell had noticed in recent get-togethers with the Bormans. Gradually, she lost her cognitive abilities. By 2015, she sometimes didn't recognize Frank or her sons and needed a full-time care facility. From the moment she showed symptoms, Frank refused to leave her side and has remained committed to her care ever since. Even at age 90, he awakens at 5:30 a.m. to exercise, not for his own benefit, but to make sure he stays alive long enough to take care of Susan until the end of her days. Every day he visits her at the facility where her room is decorated with photos of her family and of the days when she and Frank had their adventures. In one, she is on the cover of a national magazine looking more radiant than a Hollywood actress. "She was really beautiful," a nurse tells Frank. "Still is," Frank says. It doesn't matter to Frank that Susan sometimes doesn't respond, or that she might not even know who he is. He still climbs into bed with her every day and lies next to her, still takes her to get her nails done at the beauty shop, still talks to her and tells her he loves her. He turns down invitations to travel or receive awards. He always eats nearby. Susan needs him. He struggles to say it without tears, but he must say it. "Susan is the best wife and best mother a person could ever hope to have. I was selfish. I was lucky." And now he must return to her. It's visiting hours at the facility. As he walks from his truck toward the front door, it is clear he is on a mission, a new mission. The only mission more important than the moon.
Hi, this is Robert Kersen, author of Rocket Men, and this is my author's note. In late 2014, I took some friends to the Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago, my hometown. It had been a few years since I'd seen U-505, the German U-boat that is one of the centerpiece attractions in the museum, and a perfect match for the submarine I wrote about in my first book, shadow divers. On the way out, we came across a space capsule, about 10 feet tall by 13 feet wide. It appeared to be scarred from its journey wherever it had gone, and its open hatch revealed three cramped seats and a universal